Bonjour et bienvenue sur Les Dessous de l'IA, le podcast qui tente de mieux comprendre les évolutions de l'intelligence artificielle et leurs impacts sur nos sociétés. Bonne écoute.
Hello Alessandro and welcome on Behind AI. Today we'll be discussing the role of semiconductor in the technological landscape and especially in the developments of AI. Could you please introduce yourself, your background and what got you interested in AI and geopolitics?
So thank you for the invitation. I'm glad to be able to talk to you about these interesting topics. My name is Alessandro Arezzo. I am 40 years old. I'm from Sardinia in Italy, the Mediterranean island. I have, I'd say, 20 years experience of writing, mostly writing in Italian media and newspapers about international affairs and international economics. It's something I have done since when I was studying at the university. I have a background in philosophy of law, and I studied particularly the relationship between law, philosophy, and economics. And also, it is worth mentioning that I'm frequent contributor to a journal of geopolitics in Italy, which is the main journal in this area. It is called Limes, the Latin word for boundaries, of course. And I've been writing for Limes for the last 20 years. So I covered mostly geopolitics in relationship to economics and industrial policy. And then in the last 10 years, I decided to focus particularly on the interplay between geopolitics and technology. And therefore, for the journal and for other publications throughout Italy and in the Italian environment, I covered a lot of technology companies. And those technology companies became also the focus of three books that I wrote starting from 2020, one in 2020, another in 2022, and the last one just a few weeks ago. So the first book is called The Powers of Political Capitalism, United States and China. And there I try to develop this view of how China and the United States are increasing their competition on technology in particular. And that brings us to a global development where national security is considered increasingly important. Therefore, we have constraints on market practices through national security. So the basic idea was that we were gonna experience a lot more of tools of economic war between the United States and China, considering in that particularly industrial policy to subsidize national companies, as well as the political use of antitrust, but also foreign investment screening and export controls. And that's what happened in the following years. So I'm happy about my thesis. And also in that book, I covered a lot Huawei as an exemplary company of the US and China competition on 5G and so on. Then the second book is focused on US-China competition in two supply chains, the supply chain of semiconductors and the supply chain of batteries and EV companies. The third book is called Geopolitics of Artificial Intelligence, and it's basically written as a geopolitical novel, a narrative centered on NVIDIA, the history of the company co-founded by Jensen Huang, why NVIDIA has become a key part of the AI ecosystem. And the book also covers the history of DeepMind and OpenAI as two key companies in that area. So to conclude, apart from this work on those books, I've been involved with the Italian government and Italian institutions for the last 12 years. I have been in several roles for the Italian government, the Prime Minister's Office, Ministry of Economy and Finance, the Italian Space Agency, Italy's Development Bank, you name it. I've done basically everything or almost everything with the Italian government. I've had the pleasure to be a government advisor, sometimes a speechwriter or a policy officer. So in the last 12 years, I'm proud of the fact that I've been able to work directly or indirectly with every Italian government. So government of all political views, I have had the pleasure and honor to work with all of them. But, you know, sometimes I resign from this position. I'm not part of the Italian civil service, so I have been called by prime ministers or ministers to advise them and to help, but then often I resign from my position because I want to focus more on the writing on those books. And then since one year I have switched to writing mostly full-time, so doing writing as well as advising companies and doing other things from working full-time from the government. So that's the story. As I said, what has been important for me has been the switch in the last decade from analyzing and writing about Italian and European geopolitics in relationship to the economy and industrial policy to a deeper focus on how technology is key to understand our times, and so focusing a lot on issues that are probably of interest of you and your listeners, of course.
Thank you very much for this introduction. To start this conversation, I would like to ask you some questions and to look back in history of semiconductors. Chris Miller, in his book Chip War, defines chip, also integrated circuit or semiconductors, as a small piece of semiconducting materials, usually silicon, with millions or billions of microscopic transistors carved into it. Could you give us a quick history of semiconductors, starting with the transistor in the late 40s, and focus also on how did Southeast Asia become so influential in this field?
Yeah, that's an important question. I think Chris Miller's definition of chips, semiconductors, is helpful for us because therefore we don't get too technical on this issue and we are able to appreciate the economic, political, and historical significance of semiconductors. This is probably the most important industry in our world because we have been living in a digital age thanks to semiconductors. So thanks, first of all, to the invention of the transistor, of course, at Bell Labs in 1947. So that is the start of the proper start of the digital age, of course. Also thanks to the work of several scientists, researchers, and thinkers. Semiconductors empower our digital life at all levels because they are included in personal computers, data centers, automobiles, all parts of electronics that we use daily. So in order to understand how this industry has been progressing, we should think about which electronic tools did we have in the 60s, in the 80s, in the 90s. So for instance, in the 90s, having widespread personal computer has been a key development, of course. And then in this century, in particular, we've seen the rise of the data center, which is which has become also more recently the key object for AI. And those are, let's say, the end markets of semiconductors. And then there's the evolution of the industry. So to make a long story short, in this industry, we have an increasing drive to performance, efficiency, energy efficiency, and precision, engineering precision, making things smaller, making things more efficient in order to have more performance. This, in this process, of course, the so-called Moore's Law has been particularly influential, first underlined by Gordon Moore in an article in 1965 as the industry was developing, particularly in the United States and in the so-called Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, as you probably know, means exactly the valley of silicon. And silicon is the key component in semiconductors. Okay, so we live in a digital world. We live in a world that has been characterized by the development of Silicon Valley and those tech hubs, and they all are around the development of the industry of semiconductors. Yeah. Also, we need to take into account, and you mentioned it, that we have been experiencing in the last, I'd say, six decades, also a key development in how in our world things are produced in general. So East Asia is the manufacturing center of the world in general. So this key trend in world economics and world history has affected a lot a key industry such as the semiconductor industry. Why? Because those end markets of electronics that I was talking about and that became a key area of growth for the semiconductor industry after the first two decades, I'd say, in which defense and security applications were the main markets. So in this drive to electronic markets also had to do with the development of manufacturing power in the 60s, 70s and 80s. That is Japan. So that's an important part of the history of semiconductors in the 20th century. Again, to make a long story short, we should think about objects such as calculators or the Walkman, increasingly produced also by Japanese companies and not only by Italian companies, by US companies, sorry. And that became a key trend for the development of a Japanese semiconductor industry. So we've had in those decades a change in the geographic composition of the industry overall due to the rise of Japan, to the economic and industrial rise of Japan, also with the very important political implications. One could talk about a first semiconductor war between Japan and the United States, particularly during the 1980s. And I think the term, even if it's strong, it's appropriate because we have had tools of economic war adopted both by Japan, particularly industrial policy, and by the United States during the Reagan administration in the 1980s, tariffs as well as foreign investment screening. We can come back to that afterwards. And that has been a significant development in the industry. At the same time, when we talk about manufacturing in East Asia, this is not only a story about Japan, but it is also a story of Western companies, particularly American companies establishing establishing plants or a way of fabrications in other East Asian countries, such as Malaysia, for instance, which has been relevant for a company like Intel since the 1970s. But then there were also other significant players that are still with us, particularly South Korea and, of course, Taiwan, which has been a key story in the development of semiconductors, particularly since the 1980s, when in 1987, Morris Chang was born in 1931 in Ningbo, then China, and then moved to study and work in the United States as an executive for a US company, Texas Instruments, then accepted the invitation by the Taiwanese government basically to establish semiconductor activities in Taiwan, and then he realized a key company which is the leader in one of the segments of the industry. So it is important, I think, to consider the history of semiconductors taking account both of the scientific and then mostly engineering developments that we have in this drive towards efficiency, towards precision by companies, and then how end markets evolve, but also how those and markets interact with the changes that we see in the manufacturing fabric of the world, and in a world where the West is not anymore the manufacturing center of the world. The manufacturing center of the world is East Asia, but you know, East Asia is also could also be considered a sloppy notion because it includes different countries with different political systems. And so now we have the relevance of places such as South Korea, but also the People's Republic of China, and of course the Republic of China, which is Taiwan. And then it, of course, there's also a key issue of how a place like Taiwan fits into this supply chain. So it's a fascinating story, very complicated, and the semiconductor value chain is even more complicated than this story.
Thank you for this brief historic reminder. You spoke about the value chain of semiconductor. You told it's even more complicated. Could you please explain us a little bit how this value chain is built? I understood that there are different stages from R&D to chip design to manufacturing. And could you also explain us what are the choke point technology and who are the main players?
Yeah, first thing to know, as I said, it's very complicated. It's very fragmented, very interconnected. I mean, in order to have one of these very small things, reality is that directly or indirectly, we have the involvement of hundreds or thousands of companies. It depends on how we measure it. So the digital fabric of our world, which is our life, it depends on a lot of companies, not only on several companies. That is also because as we were discussing before, the dominant model of the semiconductor industry is not anymore as 50 years ago or 60 years ago, a company which does everything. This doesn't exist. And this is also impossible. This is worth mentioning and worth considering. It's impossible that we're going to have in the near future a company doing everything in this supply chain. So that is not going to happen. And there are a lot of false myths on that. So the fact, for instance, that a company like TSMC is a company that does everything. Of course, that's not true. Because as I said, there's this integrated and complicated supply chain. There are also different ways to measure this supply chain. So I will tell the story from one of the ways in which we can divide the supply chain into various segments. There is R&D activity. R&D activity done both by private companies, but also by some research centers. Consider, for instance, research centers in the US, but also in Europe. In Europe, there's a very important one in Belgium, which is called IMEC, for instance. Another key area has to do with what is generally called electronic design automation. So basically, to put it very simply, these are companies who build specific tools that are used for the process of chip design. So there are several companies, some companies that are focused just on this. These are mainly US companies. The leader is called Synopsys, and then another company is Cadence Systems. There's also Mentor Graphics, which is US-based but owned by Siemens, the German company. So that's a segment. Another segment is what is properly chip design, the design of chips. So it means I'm designing a chip, but I'm not producing it. Another company is in charge of the manufacturing fabrication process. So those other companies, they do produce stuff for me, stuff which I design. So the chip design overall is also the main segment for added value of the industry overall. So in chip design, we have companies like Apple, for instance. Apple is the designer of chips for the iPhone and its other tools, and they are produced by others, by TSMC mostly. But then there are a lot of other companies, such as NVIDIA, of course, the world leader in artificial intelligence, in chips for artificial intelligence, as well as one of the main world companies by market capitalization now, but also companies such as Qualcomm, Broadcom, AMD. These are all US-based. There are Taiwanese companies such as MediaTek, for instance, also in this area, also Chinese companies. For instance, iSilicon is the design division of Huawei, therefore a key player, particularly in the US-China technology war, of course. But then if we move to what do chip designers need in order to have their chip, it gets, of course, even more complicated. Basically, as we said, it is a place of production and manufacturing is needed. So this is a plant, what is called generally in the industry fab. A plant for the production of semiconductors. Those plants, those fabs, they cost now a huge amount of money to be started and for their operation. And that is because of the evolution of the industry towards efficiency and so on that we talked about before. So consider that you are a company that produces semiconductors for others, which is now the dominant model. So basically, Morris Chang's business idea, based also on some studies by researchers and scientists, particularly Kaffir Mead and the late Lynn Conway, was to split the production process and the design process. And that made possible the rise of this incredible ecosystem of design companies. So companies such as NVIDIA, basically they have been able to exist and thrive because of Morris Chang's business intuition regarding this separation of design and production. So we are talking about a huge thing. What Morris Chang business intuition is one of the greatest one in, I'd say, in the economic history of humanity for its impact. And then what is the result of that? The result of that, as I said, is those plants, those fabs, which now can cost 1 billion euros or dollars, as you want, and 5 billion, 10 billion, 20 billion. So we keep hearing about that. So the next question is, why do they cost so much? So the producers, the manufacturers, absorb this cost, and what they pay for mostly is the kind of machinery and equipment that is needed for the production process. So this is another segment, so-called semiconductor manufacturing equipment, which is absolutely key in the industry. And then we have several players from several countries, but particularly they are US-based companies such as Applied Materials, Lam Research, KLA. We are talking about important companies. I mean, for instance, just to make an example, the annual revenue of Applied Materials is about $30 billion. So this is a huge company, even if it's not so much well-known outside the experts in those fields, but also Japanese companies such as Tokyo Electron, Nikon, Canon. And then there are also European players, among them the most important and the most well-known is the Dutch company ASML, which has a monopoly in specific process, a very advanced process. But then we need to imagine those plants, those fabs, and all this money, millions and millions that are spent on different machinery. Also, another often underrated issue is that there is a lot of chemistry involved in the semiconductor industry. Of course, even Gordon Moore was a chemist by training, but this means that the segment in the semiconductor industry is all the part of chemicals and industrial gases, for instance, that are needed for the production process. And then you have companies that do that, some small chemicals by Japanese companies, but also European powerhouses like the German BASF or Air Liquide from France. So those are key as well for the semiconductor industry. And then it's not even over when we have a part of the involvement. Of course, in chemicals, there are also materials, wafer fabrication, but it's not even over when we have the chip, because there's a process of testing, and then so-called assembly and packaging at various stages. So also for these final processes, we have a series of companies specialized on that. Particularly, they are Asian companies. So from Taiwan, Japan, but also China. So that's a view of one could really talk about that for 2-3 hours, given how it's complicated. But as I said, it's complicated, but as I was explaining, there are some leaders in this area. So one should consider that doing what, let's say, Synopsys does for electronic design automation or the machinery and equipment of Applied Materials. It's not that you and I, we start a company and we are able to do that. So that can't happen, because there's a lot of expertise in doing this. Well, so when in the value chain you acquire a specific expertise on a specific process, you have a strong position in a value chain. And so understanding which those leaders are, where they are based, and also which markets they rely on for the revenue and profits gives us an understanding of the political and geographic way in which the industry is based on.
You mentioned something I would like to move on now in your introduction, geoeconomic tools. In 2016, President Obama issued an executive order blocking the acquisition of the German company Aixtron, which specializes in semiconductor production technology, which potentially could be used in military application. And it was blocked because a Chinese investment group wanted to acquire this company. This executive order was based on the recommendation from the Committee on Foreign Investments. And I would like if you can explain us a little bit what is this mechanism, foreign investment screening, and also how this event, which happened in 2016, set geopolitical precedent and led to other regions like Europe to strengthen their own foreign investment screening mechanism?
Yeah, I think this is a key question. This has been very important in my work. I was mentioning before this notion of the first semiconductor war between the United States and Japan. What did happen in the 80s and the 80s decade and this competition between the US and Japan? Bear in mind that it is a key period in order to understand the time we live in. In the Reagan administration at that time was working Robert Lighthizer, who has been the US trade representative then 30 years later under President Trump. And he's going to be the trade representative in the new Trump administration. So the mind of those people, like Lighthizer, but also Trump, were influenced a lot by this competition between the US and Japan. So we are talking about one of the most important economic issues of our time in contemporary history. What happened was that due to the strength in electronics and manufacturing of Japan that we have mentioned before, there was a round of acquisitions of US companies by Japanese companies, or proposals on that. And then in the middle of the decade, in the 1980s, a Japanese powerhouse, Fujitsu, wanted to acquire a company of historical significance for the semiconductor industry, Fairchild Semiconductor. From Fairchild, the process was accompanied by William Shockley, then Fairchild Semiconductor, then Intel. So Fairchild Semiconductor was really at the center of the history of the US semiconductor industry. And the Japanese wanted to acquire that company. And then we had a strong debate in the US business and political circles on this potential acquisition. And the outcome of that debate was the change of the nature of a body called CFIUS, Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States, that started in the 1970s, basically to study flows of foreign investment and commerce into the United States. And then through the intervention of Congress, this was transformed in a body that was able to recommend to the President of the United States for vetoing an acquisition, blocking this acquisition. So this all happened mostly during the Reagan administration. So it is also interesting to consider that a president that we think about as the free marketer par excellence, when it had to do with those technology, it was the time when these tools were developed. So it not only the block of the acquisition, but also, to make a long story short, this political debate with the US administration and the Congress, ultimately there was no Fujitsu Fairchild semiconductor deal at that time. So what has happened and in my view, it is a very important development. Cepheus, this significant power of Cepheus and these potential vetoes on acquisition by foreigners of US companies, this wasn't used a lot in the decades since the 1980s, because the United States position was more favorable to free trade, globalization, and so on. But then we've had another development, the rise of the People's Republic of China, Chinese ambition, particularly after the Great Recession, which basically did not touch China very much in comparison to Western nations. So this technological drive of potential acquisitions by China, also in particular after the Made in China 2025 plan was presented in 2015. So what happened? This intention by China to acquire intellectual property of Western companies, it reactivated Cepheus and made it even more significant than before. So if we analyze in the last decade how the M&A outlook of the semiconductor industry has been influenced by foreign investment screening, that means government intervention, political intervention in those deals, this has been very significant. And I think that the Ahlstrom case is really important in that area, because Ahlstrom is a German company. Is a German company in the segment of semiconductor manufacturing equipment. Not a very large company, not a top, no, it's not ASML or Applied Material. So, but it's important, because almost everything is important there. So what was the US reasoning behind that? A Chinese vehicle, a tool connected with the Chinese state, therefore the Communist Party of China wanted to acquire Ahlstrom. Ahlstrom had both significant activities and clients in the United States. And this is enough for the United States to intervene on the fate of a German company, on the fate of a non-US company. And so the outgoing Obama administration, because Trump, this was late 2016, Trump has already been elected, and we were going to have inauguration of President Trump in early 2017, of course, decided to block the acquisition. So no deal. Now Ahlstrom is still a German company. So it's the first case of this rise of foreign investment screening. And then we've had a lot of developments also on foreign investment screening in the European Union regarding technology, supply chains. And now most, almost all European member states have tools similar to Cepheus, even if they are not so much powerful. They are used for several industries, for instance, you know, in France, and there have been even foreign investment screening for avoiding an acquisition of Carrefour by Canadian companies. So they are used for everything, because the technology significance of Carrefour is zero compared to the semiconductor industry. But for the semiconductor industry, there we've had a lot of cases of this political intervention into mergers and acquisition in the industry.
You mentioned it before, but another tool in this geoeconomic toolbox is export control. And you mentioned Huawei. In 2019, Huawei was added to the US entity list, blocking US company or just using US technology from selling goods, technology to Huawei, especially semiconductors. In 2022, the US also restricted the sale of advanced AI processors to China. To understand how this mechanism works and how microprocessors become such significant geopolitical issue between US, China and their allies?
Let's start from the last part. How did they become so significant? I'd say two things. First of all, semiconductors, even if defense and security is certainly not a large market for semiconductors, they are still key for military uses and applications. Therefore, they are both needed for weapons systems, but also for instance, supercomputers that have uses for the military. So we should bear in mind this when we have competition, which is also at military level, potentially at the military level, such as the US-China competition, and of course, microelectronics is relevant for that. Second point, which is often underrated, as I said before, end users markets are key for the development of the semiconductor industry. And what does it mean for the Chinese development? Let me make two examples. So as you know, how does the smartphone market work? We have who is producing smartphones in the world? Basically, it's the United States, Apple, the Koreans, Samsung, and then a series of Chinese companies, okay? Since the fall of Nokia, the Europeans are not in the smartphone business. So China's rise in the smartphone business gave China a strong position in a very important, with a lot of money and revenue, end users market of semiconductors. So China's play in that was similar to that of Japan that we have talked before. We have companies in the end market, particularly Huawei, of course. And then we are going to exploit these to move up the value chain of semiconductors. Therefore, you have the design arm of Huawei iSilicon, which became a key client for TSMC. And that was a very contentious issue. So in some years, iSilicon was the second client of TSMC immediately after Apple. So a significant shift that also we can connect to the contentious role of Huawei. The Huawei case is larger, of course. It had to do with the arrest of the daughter of the founder and chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, in Vancouver, in Canada. She was accused. She had allegations about basically Huawei's role in avoiding U.S. sanctions to Iran and North Korea. So it's a complicated case. But then the outcome was that the United States, as you said, added Huawei to a U.S. entity list. And that means that there's a list in the Department of Commerce in the United States. If you put a company there, you cannot have, as a U.S. company, normal trade with that company. So you need licenses by the U.S. government in order to trade with them. Basically, that's the thing. But with Huawei, these export controls tools, which were developed at the earlier stage for military purposes, were used also to force a change in supplier-client relationship, okay? Particularly that between Huawei and TSMC. Because TSMC, as we said before, is not self-sufficient and does not want to be. TSMC success relies both on its clients, so companies like Apple, Nvidia, and Huawei as well, a few years ago at least. And then on suppliers, so what the US government decided to use as leverage, the key role that US companies have in TSMC plants, fabs. So if you don't have products by US company, you cannot operate. So that's a leverage with TSMC. And this has been a significant part of this process.
Due to the significant importance of semiconductor in our digital world and the lack of domestic production, US, Europe and China all announced initiative to boost domestic production. How do these policies differ and what impact could they have on global AI development?
So that's another important question. I'd say policies by China were key in the last decade because their financing of the semiconductor industry in the pursuit of trying to climb the value chain that we talked about and building a series of national champions in those segments, with, of course, also a lot of public money. This has been the trigger of the chip war that we are living. So that's very significant. So that now Chinese policies, I'd say it's complicated, but in a nutshell, they have not to do just with the public money invested by the central government and the local governments, but also in the coordination between companies. For instance, now Huawei, this comeback kid, as the Americans say, in the semiconductor story, is acting as a key player in the supply chain in order to let other companies, for instance, in the semiconductor manufacturing equipment, coordinate with the Chinese supply chain, okay? And also, if the Chinese have national champions in end-user markets, a key example is the Chinese EV player BYD, they also work on semiconductors. So BYD owns, operates plants for semiconductors. There's an arm of BYD doing semiconductor chip design. So that's how the Chinese system operates. United States, so we've had two focus. The first that we have talked about before is foreign investment screening, export control, so political intervention in the supply chain of semiconductor. Second focused is the so-called the Chips and Science Act of 2022, so mostly grants and public money in order to facilitate and incentivize companies such as Intel, TSMC, and Samsung, and others to build manufacturing facilities in the United States, given that the United States are leaders in several areas of the supply chain, but they are certainly backwards in both manufacturing and test assembly and packaging part. So the last, not last but not least, but last and least is the European Union, because the plans of the European Union cannot be even compared to those of China and the United States. Main reason is almost no common public money by the European Union. So the European Union advertised this figure of 43 billions for semiconductors, but this is actually not true, because the EU money is about 3 billion. So it's really nothing for the semiconductor industry. And the other 40, more or less, are considered investment by European member states. So my message is there is no coordinated policy with dozens of billions, but there's peanuts, a few money from the EU, also because of how the EU's budget works. It's not easy for the EU's budget to find, like 50, 100 billion for anything, because you have agriculture, other stuff, taking the money, and then some coordination by European member states, which is difficult to obtain.
Now, if we try to project ourselves in the future regarding your expertise on this field, how do you envision the semiconducting industry evolving over the next decade, particularly with regard to AI? Could you expect some major shifts or breakthrough?
Yeah, I mean, AI is now in a very important market in the semiconductor industry. So in those end markets that we talked about, what have we experienced? We have experienced, particularly in the last 2 years, skyrocketing rise of the data center market, because AI is a series of data center. Basically, that's what AI is. AI cannot function in training, the process of training and inference, without data centers. So data centers are becoming a key market for the semiconductor industry. And this is the story of the rise of NVIDIA. NVIDIA, before other companies, so we are talking about 12 years ago, 10 years ago, identified this potential development and invested in it. So because of that, NVIDIA has a dominant position. And a lot of things suggest that this dominant position, of course, I talk more in more detail in my book, this is going to endure for at least the foreseeable futures, but there are issues on that. For instance, issues of supply and demand. So what's going to happen? What's still going to happen in the next years? In the next year, for instance, there's going to be a lot of demand for these AI products, but then they are not difficult, not easy to build. So we should always think that it's not just NVIDIA. But NVIDIA needs TSMC with its stuff, but then there's also memory, which is involved, we haven't talked about. So it's a Korean company, SK Hynix and others, but also in these systems, these servers, we have the interconnect, we have packaging, we also have materials such as steel and copper in particular, and then we have those servers, which need to be assembled. They are assembled generally by Foxconn, another Taiwanese companies. So I see a lot of risk as well as opportunity for this demand supply interplay.
In a study published in Le Grand Continent, which is a famous French online and paper, you call ASML the invisible center of global technology. Could you just tell us briefly about the story of this company and how its success might inspire a strategy for reinforcing technological independence in Europe?
Yeah, basically, my argument is this. You know, I've received emails by people from the Netherlands saying, oh, you say that ASML is invisible, but everyone here in the Netherlands talk about ASML. Okay, maybe in the Netherlands more people know about ASML, but I can bet all my money that ASML is not known even in the Netherlands as TSMC is known in Taiwan. So what happens in Taiwan if Morris Chang is walking down the street? And he is considered a living god, basically. So it is well known as Olivo Doctor or as Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi. And I think this cultural significance is very important. When Jensen Huang walks around the streets of Vietnam, for instance, really, everyone knows that it's Jensen Huang. I mean, if Jensen Huang comes to Paris or Rome, I don't think that is going to be recognized. So I make also these studies in order to let European, help European people understand how East Asians culturally, they really understood how this industry is key. And culture is an important thing. So knowing the ASML story is important. Having kids in the classroom talking about technology success stories, this is inspiring and important. And the story of ASML, the company, is now 40 years old. And I think then in the story of these companies, there are lessons for Europeans. So success was due also to luck, because ASML has been a beneficiary of the US-Japan competition in that specific segment of the industry, but also a clear focus on clients and suppliers. So the ASML supply chain in Europe is very important. The close relationship, particularly with the two German companies, Zeiss and Trumpf, has been key to ASML success. So this relationship with suppliers. And another very important thing has been relationship with the capital markets. So ASML was very ambitious since the beginning and has identified capital markets, making an early IPO and finding finance as a way to let the company grow. So the other message is you cannot have industrial and technological development without a strong strategy for finance and capital markets. So I'd summarize culture, general culture, and second, key relationship with suppliers and clients, and third, the role of capital markets as some of the lessons that we can learn from ASML great success. And also there are also challenges for ASML, but we are talking about a technological powerhouse, which for instance really in the world puts a place like the Netherlands in the picture or in the map, in the radar. It's almost all because of ASML's story.
We are arriving at the end of this conversation. I have one last question for you. If you had to propose three concrete actions for Europe to achieve greater sovereignty in the microprocessor sector by 2030, or let's say a decade, what would this proposal be?
So let me say, because you know, I'm quite provocative on this issue. Europe says we're going to get to 20% of global revenue or value added of semiconductors. Let's forget about that, because it's zero chance that this is going to happen. If we say about these percentages, 8%, 10%, 20%, we are never going to reach it. We are never going to reach 20%, because as I said, there are a lot of players in the world. The US is coming back very strongly on some areas. Korea will try and defend its position. TSMC's excellency cannot be reached in the near future. China is very ambitious. And then we now have India wanting to play a role in this. And India is one of the most populous country in the world, more than 1.5 billion people. And so what are the Europeans going to do against India? So let's not shoot these percentages, because it's not helpful. We look like clowns if we do this percentage game. So let's forget this number. And then let us talk about serious stuff. First is that the semiconductor industry is built on industrial niches, choke points. Therefore, for us, it is key to maintain and defend and increase our choke points. Because even if in terms of percentages we cannot play a significant role, that simply doesn't matter, because choke points matter. Therefore, identifying our strengths in the proper way, and then increasing our investment on our strengths, it's a very important. This has also to do with the end markets. So basically, if we lose the automotive industry in Europe, we cannot have semiconductor industry for automotive. So we protect some of our niches, which are related to automotive, through the protection of our automotive industry. So that's an important part. Second point is capital markets union and the EU on capital markets. The semiconductor industry relies strongly on finance. Therefore, if we do not have a strong systems for financing in Europe, we are going to lose more and more of semiconductors. So in this continent, we are talking about the Capital Markets Union. It's been 10 years, 12 years. Let's build this thing because it's going to be a key infrastructure also for semiconductors. That's the second point. Third and final point has to do with the chemical companies. So we need to prove the EU regulation for chemical players, because chemical players are a key strength for Europe in the semiconductor industry. But we are increasingly losing our chemical strengths in Europe because of regulation, EU regulation and national regulation. So I propose let's face the fact that both the digital transition and the ecological green transition, they rely on chemistry. Therefore, we should delete all the regulation that is not beneficial for EU chemical companies. So every part of the Green Deal, which is against the operation of chemical companies in Europe, or which makes life difficult for chemical companies, everything about this regulation should be deleted. And that would be simple thing, even if, I mean, it doesn't cost much. We should just delete regulation, put it in the recycle bin, and this would be very beneficial for the EU semiconductor industry.
Thanks a lot for answering my question, Alessandro, and I hope you'll talk again soon.
L'épisode est maintenant terminé. J'espère qu'il vous a plu. N'hésitez pas à le partager autour de vous et à vous abonner au podcast pour écouter les prochains épisodes. À bientôt.